Big edition of The Breakfast Club. It's great to have your company. If you missed any of the good stuff, here's a snippet of what we did.
I have no doubt that Adam White enjoyed the AFL Hall of Fame, the Australian Football Hall of Fame last night. He's that sort of fella. Good morning, Whitey.
Yeah, I did actually. Good morning to you. It is one of my favourite nights of the year. I think that having been to the night before, but also watching it on television, and to me, it's just all about listening to the stories of the people that are inducted into the Hall of Fame. It's not necessarily the names as such. It's just learning more about the game and the way it's been played. And to me, it's just as interesting hearing about someone that played football in the 1950s or the 1970s as it was a more modern-day player like it was last night with both Simon Goodwin and Barry Hall. I love the night because you learn more about the game.
Yeah. Yeah, and you're right about the personalities and the stories that come out. Yeah. It's always some of the speeches in the Hall of Fame over the last decade have been just sensational.
Yeah, absolutely. Sensational. And we learn more about the SANFL and the Waffle. And last night, Brett Allen was put into the Hall of Fame, who was an umpire that, when you look at his record, it was extraordinary how many grand finals he umpired in the time that he was in the game. And then, of course, Malcolm Blake gets elevated into legend status. And you sort of reminisce on, in a lot of ways, I'm going to feel like my dad here, or sound like my dad here, how much better the game was when he played.
Oh, don't go down that track. Good morning to you, Sherelle McMahon, our very own legend here on The Breakfast Club.
Good morning. Good morning. Yeah, I tuned in a little bit to the Hall of Fame last night, and I love it as well. I think it's great to hear all those stories and, as you say, to learn a little bit more. But was there a moment where I thought maybe we could tighten it a bit? That was all.
Oh, just a bit of tightening.
A little bit, maybe. The
production activity. You've been in TV for too long now. Look at you. Look at you, you little TV superstar. Now you're talking about production values.
Yeah, no. It was probably just because I wanted to get to bed because it was getting too late.
Well, that's the other point, yes. When you're working this shift, you don't want anything to go too late.
No,
past
right.
9 o'clock, you're starting to think, look at your watch.
And plus, I'm probably still recovering from the grand final on the weekend.
Well, we're going to talk more about that with Seabass, but my understanding is that you partied like it was 1999. That's what I've heard. That's what I've heard. Smack, that's what I've heard, that you partied like you haven't for a long time.
Well, not for a long time, although to be fair, in 99 I was probably partying harder than I did just for the one night on Saturday night. And it was great. It's the first year that netball has been a part of Channel 9 and the Wide World of Sports team. And it was great to go out with the crew. As you say, I've been working on that broadcast side of it, and that was really nice because I've really enjoyed, I think Channel 9 has done a great job with the netball. I think we've still got definitely some leaps to make to make things better
just
next year. Tighten things up a bit for next year. But it just coincidentally, our venue for drinks after the game was the same one as the Lightning, the Premiership winners.
No way.
So, they were probably the ones that just stretched our night out a little bit, but it was fun.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, that'll be nice. I'm looking forward to talking to Seabass about that. It's nice to celebrate a year that's gone. It's, in terms of when you cover things, and we do it at the footy every year, there's always a night or a lunch to just farewell the year and what you've done, because you work pretty hard throughout that year.
Yeah, you do. And it's not obviously just there's so many people involved in putting sport to air. So it's really nice just to kind of sit down and reminisce about some of those moments. And, you know, the grand final, while it was a bit of a blowout, it was still a really great game and a lot of fantastic stories for the Lightning through there.
Is there, just going back to the Hall of Fame for a second, is there a netball equivalent? Is there an Australian Netball Hall of Fame?
Yes, there is.
Is there?
Yeah, there is. Yeah,
why don't I know anything about that?
That's a good question. I'm not sure.
I know
why
most things
don't
about this type of thing.
Okay.
But I don't know about that.
No, well, We had a legend elevated last night. We've got one legend in netball, and that is Joyce Brown. She was elevated to that.
Oh, yes.
At the World Cup a couple of years ago. So there's only one who's been given the nod in that, and I couldn't think of anyone better than Joyce Brown. But, yeah, we do. We certainly do. And when I was inducted into the Sports Australia Hall of Fame last year, Wally Lewis, who we're talking to later, was elevated to a legend as well in that same time. So it was great hearing from him and his stories.
It's nice to be inducted as a Hall of Fame member in your sport, Whitey, but when you're inducted into the Australian Sport Hall of Fame, like our good friend Sherelle, it's rare.
It makes us, well, certainly in my case, a bit intimidated by the presence of such sporting royalty, Daniel.
Well, that's why she's on the throne. Sure. That's reserved for sporting royalty. So there's no surprise.
Now, I want to throw this up straight away because I think what happened last night was a bit special on the other side of the world.
What happened last night?
Thanasi Kokkinakis defeated Milos Raonic at Queens. Yes. Then Jordan Thompson defeated Andy Murray at Queens.
Yes.
Ash Barty and Daria Gavrilova won their respective matches. And Bernard Tomic won his match in Germany. Now, we have reached the grass court season when the Australians have always traditionally done pretty well. But just having talked about the disappointment yesterday of Nick Kyrgios having to pull out of his match with an injury to his hip, to have those results last night. Thanasi Kokkinakis, he's ranked 700 in the world at the moment, and he is a real forgotten man of Australian tennis because he and Nick Kyrgios were coming through at the same time, and there wasn't too much difference between the two of them, standard-wise. But unfortunately, over the last 2.5 years, Kokkinakis has had a series of injuries. We just haven't seen him play any tennis at all. But now
it's amazing how your ranking can drop that far that quickly.
Yeah, we didn't
have a long way back.
Yeah, I mean, he kind of didn't have an injury protected ranking because he had a variety of different injuries, so he sort of would come back and then go out again and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But you know, I can't stress enough how good this guy is, Thanasi Kokkinakis, and I thought it was to beat Raonic on grass. Okay, he's probably not all wound up because he's getting ready for Wimbledon, but we are only a week and a half away, so you want to be playing some pretty good tennis at the moment. And he was able to do that. I think that was very, very impressive.
Well, we've always loved Thanasi for the way he carries himself and projects his
most of the time
image. He's pretty good.
Yeah, exactly.
Special K.
Pretty good.
He's pretty good for a boy. He's just still a boy. When you compare him to some of the other young men we've had through the journey in the last 5 years or so, Thanasi's certainly at the top of the tree. So that was a big win. What about Jordan Thompson?
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's pretty Andy Murray.
I just drove off the road when Andrew Mays on the Breakfast Bite, the award-winning Breakfast Bite, told me that as I was driving in. That was amazing. It actually probably says more about Andy Murray than it does about Jordan Thompson because Murray has been struggling. And we know that Novak Djokovic has been struggling and we've seen Federer and Nadal win the first two Grand Slams of the year. We sort of felt that it was always going to be about Murray and Djokovic and the next group coming through, but it's been the older guys that have been winning stuff because Djokovic and Murray haven't been at the top of their game.
So going into Wimbledon, and you can talk about the quality of tennis you want to be playing for Raonic and Murray, what sort of confidence do they get, do you reckon, Thompson and Kokkinakis? Probably Kokkinakis particularly because he's been out for so long. When you get that win over someone who is a real competitor and a real contender for these sort of titles, what does it do for him, do you reckon?
Well, it's massive because of it's who it is. Raonic, okay, he's not the best player in the world, but he reached the Wimbledon final last year. He's top six, top seven in the world. He won in straight sets, so he was really good at saving break points. So he was really he provided some really good clutch moments. So that will be the thing that will give him the most confidence that when he was under pressure, he was able to perform really well. I'm not suggesting he's going to go out there and reach the quarterfinals of Wimbledon, but it was just a reminder of the quality of tennis that this guy can play. It's all been about Kyrgios over the last couple of years since he's sort of gone past Tomic. But Kokkinakis is a different player, but in a lot of ways he's a much more reliable player. And my understanding, I was talking to someone in tennis yesterday, before he'd played his match, that he's got a lot more speed on his serve. Now, he was someone that could serve 200 kilometres an hour. He's got a bit more pop on his serve now, and if that's the case, then he's going to be holding serve a lot easier, which is going to make him a much better tennis player than what he was before he got injured.
Is that the official lingo, pop?
Yeah, well, pop means that he can generate a bit more spin, a bit more kick on his serve, which means it's harder to return. It's not necessarily about the speed. Pop's about the revolutions he can place on the ball when he hits it.
So it's a pop off the court, not the pop off the racket.
Yeah, yeah. It's what you can generate off with hitting the ball off the tennis that'll hit the
surface,
and it will explode.
There you go. I like it.
And the higher we can get the ball to pop, the more difficult it is to return.
One of Sam Stosur's great strengths has always been the pop that she can create on her second serve. When a lot of female tennis players' second serves, you know, are not particularly good, that's one of the great advantages that she's got on other tennis players.
I've just seen one of the great glaring omissions in the history of Australian sport, just going through the Australian Netball Hall of Fame. I don't see, Whitey, I don't see our good friend Sherelle. I don't see her name on the list.
Well, clearly she's not eligible because she hasn't been out of the game
Are you on the list? You're not on the list.
I'm not on the list.
Why are you not in the Australian Netball Hall of Fame? You're in the Sport Australia Hall of Fame, for goodness sake. Right, you shouldn't answer that.
Quite enough to say.
You shouldn't answer that. I'm going to put a campaign together because this is absolutely ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. You've been down a slide in a toboggan. I mean, in a Wonder Woman outfit. If you can't make the Australian Netball Hall of Fame on the back of that, what the hell is going on?
You know the thing I love more than anything and why my heart is still a Sharon is I know now that every boy and every girl, every boy and every girl in this country can play our game and love it.
Part of Malcolm Blight's speech yesterday as he was elevated to a legend of Australian football at the Hall of Fame night last night. Of course, when you go through his resume, there is no doubt that he fits the bill. And a legend must change the game. And Blighty certainly did that just about from every aspect, as a commentator, as a coach, and of course as a legendary player as well. Going through his record, 163 games with Woodville in the Sandville, 359 goals, 178 games for the Kangaroos, 444 goals, a Brownlow medal in 78, a McGarry in 72, the team of the year in the VFL in 1982, a Woodville BNF twice, Coleman medalist, which is extraordinary to think about where he played and how he played, North Melbourne leading goal kicker on four different occasions, two-time premiership player, Woodville captain coach, Victorian captain, South Australian captain, think about that for a second, All-Australian twice, VFL coach, of course, AFL coach with North Melbourne, Geelong, Adelaide and St Kilda, was an inaugural inductee to the Australian Football Hall of Fame, the Sandville Team of the Century and the South Australian Football Hall of Fame. He is absolutely entitled to be a legend of Australian football. And everyone's got great memories or a great memory of Malcolm Blight. And I'm glad that in the paper today, upon reflection and celebrating his contribution to the game, his elevation to legend, that they've got one of mine in one of the photos after the first flag for Adelaide 97, where he comes in and he takes a hanger on the celebration pack. Like, it's not as if he pushes down on the shoulders and just launches himself into the air. He gets his knee up, which is so very Malcolm Blight thing to, such a very Malcolm Blight thing to do. It was his technique that made him great. And when he's celebrating with his boys after that grand final in 97, he actually tries to take a hanger on his group of players who are celebrating, which I think is one of the most iconic things that we associate with Malcolm Blight, his big hangers and, of course, that talk. But I reckon that's one of the great moments for Malcolm Blight, the hanger after the 97 flag.
It was sort of representative of the way he thought about football, and that was to entertain and to attack.
It's like you on the golf course.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But Josh Kay put this stat up last night, statistician guru. Over a six-week stretch in 1992 when he was coaching Geelong, the Cats scored 198 against Richmond, 131 against West Coast, 175 against Fitzroy, 239 against Brisbane, 210 against Adelaide, and 181 against Essendon.
That's a high-scoring period.
And you know, that was the way he coached. He coached, as he said last night, to score at least one more goal than the opposition. You know, it was about scoring goals and playing attacking football, and that was my the reason I said what I said before, is that when you go back to those eras, whether it be when he played or whether it be when he coached, particularly at Geelong, it was great football. It was attacking offensive footy.
Yeah.
It was entertaining football. He wanted his players to enjoy playing football and to be able to express themselves out on the field, and they played accordingly.
Absolutely.
Except St Kilda.
Well, he spoke about St Kilda, which is interesting because he almost seems still a bit peeved that he got the boot after all these years. And you listen to some of the stories of the St Kilda people at the time that he perhaps wasn't as invested in his coaching as perhaps he had been in previous campaigns. So I was surprised to hear that last night.
Yeah, but I think that that shows his character too, because, you know, that was a hit for him, you know, I think he's a supremely competitive beast. We've seen that, and not someone who is not that way doesn't achieve what he has achieved over his career. So I think that that's probably what we're still seeing, you know, that rather than anything deeper, just, you know, he's competitive and he wanted to do well, and it didn't turn out that way.
One thing that did get me thinking about, and listening to you say that, and then the Neil Craig video for Simon Goodwin, which was online last night, which I saw, it spoke about an elite mindset and the different beast that the greats are to the run-of-the-mill athletes. And it's got me thinking about people that I played with and how different they were from a mental perspective. I imagine you would have the same sort of assessment of the greats in yep. netball, Sherelle, that you dealt with, and the ones that were good players but never really went on to be greats, that there was just something different about the way that the greats thought.
Definitely something different. And it's sometimes, and obviously each of the athletes are a little bit different in the way they go about it, but they're is just an uncompromising kind of do almost anything to win kind of mentality. Mm. And I think that gets taken further with the greats than with the players who are really good players and do a great job. But with the greats, there's just something about it that takes them to that next level.
You've been around plenty, Whitey, through the journey in cricket and footy and tennis and the like, and come across absolute greats and then really good players who perhaps should have been great, but were never. Have you been able to identify the traits that separate?
I think, to me, a lot of it is got to do with strong leadership and having courage to make decisions that are difficult but will ultimately be to the betterment of the organisation you're working in. And I think of Malcolm Blight and the controversy attached to when he went to the Adelaide Crows to be able to say to people like Andrew Jarman and Craig McDermott, that we're moving past you.
Chris
McDermott.
Craig was bowling beautiful outswingers at the time. Right? With the zinc on his name.
Yeah, that's right. Even in day-night games. But I think that, you know, it was the courage to be able to say and the strong leadership to be able to say, no one's bigger than the individual. And I think at the time everyone thought, what are you doing? You know, these guys are just icons of South Australian football. And he had immediate success. And I think the other thing too with Malcolm Blight that stands out to me is that he wasn't conventional, and that, you know, he had some pretty weird views on football in a lot of ways, but a lot of them actually worked. And I think that if you think of him and you think of Kevin Sheedy particularly as two that stand out to me, is that they were prepared to be brave and bold and do things that were a little bit unique. And yeah, okay, they probably stood out at times. But yeah, I think that they're the things that sort of stand out to me.
It should be acknowledged the other Hall of Fame inductees last night too. Brett Allen, of course, who you referenced before, umpired in 7 AFL Grand Finals amongst his 347 games. Simon Goodwin, these days the Melbourne coach, 275 games for the Crows, 5-time All-Australian, a couple of best and fairest. He was very, very good. John Halbert played for Sturt, a McGarry medalist in 1961. 244 games for them, 253 goals. Barry Hall, we know pretty well with his time at St Kilda, Sydney, and the Bulldogs, All-Australian Premiership captain and leading goal kicker umpteen times. Anthony Stevens, who I played against a lot in my career, just a fabulous player for the Kangas, 292 games. Victorian representative, All-Australian, Premiership player and best and fairest in Premiership years, more importantly, North Melbourne captain, Team of the Century member. And Ron Todd, whose legend grew last night with his induction into the Hall of Fame. Just the 76 games for Collingwood through the VFL, but 141 games for Williamstown. In 1945, Ron Todd kicked 188 goals.
Wow.
Not surprisingly, Willie won the flag that year. Well done to all of those in their induction to the Australian Football Hall of Fame. Paul Banks, it was at Royal Ascot. He joins us on the line after day one activities. G'day, Paul.
G'day, gentlemen. G'day, Sherelle.
Nice. Hi, Paul. How are we going? Good.
We are very well. How was day one of the famous Royal Ascot Carnival?
Very hot. it was a massive English summer here today. Our English folk were dropping like flies, but they survived underneath the silk hats, and we got through the meeting, and our Queen of the Turf didn't let us down either.
Now, of course, Michelle Payne, being the Queen of the Turf, who was there trying to make history at Royal Ascot, as she's done plenty of times before, Paul, as you well know. Before we get to Michelle, you sent us some great video. You seem to be enjoying your time. Send us some great video, which we'll tweet out to our listeners at the RSN Breakfast Twitter page. showed us a little bit of insight behind the scenes and walking up under the tunnel out onto the track when Michelle was making her way out there. And one thing I did notice, which made me laugh a little bit, was that the camera guys and the sound crew guys, they were also in the top hat and tails, which looked a bit funny as they were strapping these big cameras to themselves.
Oh, well, at the end of the day, you're not allowed there if you're not in the right gear. I forgot to send you a photo of myself.
No, well, the videos are great. Tomorrow. So tell us about Michelle. What was she like in the build-up? Because I imagine, even though she's had some great success and broken records and rewrote history here in Australia, being over there at Ascot would be a very different kettle of fish, wouldn't it?
Oh, look, just pure professional, though. She, absolutely down to a T. And, you know, she wasn't on the greatest horse in the race, of course, 80-1. Last start winner at Newbury, had some upsides to it. Front-running horse. She sat it out the back today, got it relaxed, a bit like a bit of a Prince of Penzance. It was actually like copybook stuff. And then when she moved up on the inside rail there, I just thought, hang on a minute, the girl's going to do it. And to run fifth in a field like that and not far behind a horse like Richester, who's just pure, pure class, it was a terrific effort. And she was absolutely chuffed with the way she rode it, and so were the connections.
Paul, what about from a UK sense of her coming over and riding? What was the attention like for her, and how did she handle all of that?
Oh, look, she just took it in her stride. And, you know, I didn't get to really chat to Michelle too much. There was a few royalty activities that I had to kind of attend to. And entree was being served and then mains and things like that. And then straight into the 2:30 kickoff. So, you know, I had to drop the pims and then wander down to the mounting yard, and then I had a lot of camera crews in my way, but I just wandered straight through like I owned it, and the moon was a balloon, I think.
Talk to us about the weather that's over there. I've heard it's around 30, is that right? And everyone's dropping like flies. What's going on? That's like a nice spring day over here.
Well, it is, but it's completely different. In the tails, it is absolutely roasting, and you just don't want to whinge in front of a pond, do you? So we've got to suck it up, us convicts. And I was taking it all in, and I just thought, look, come on, God, geez, we wear a jumper in this weather, like hell we do. But it was very, very hot. But there was a bit of a cool breeze. And look, the racing was really, really smart today. It was only six on the car, 2.4 million in stakes, Australian. I can understand why some of the lads don't come over here, but with that type of... But it's the prestige of Ascot. It's a matter of putting your livestock on the map, either it be, you know, fillies, mares, or entire.
There are great sporting carnivals and events across the globe, and for me, I was fortunate enough to go to Augusta for the US Masters, which was always one of my dreams about 10 years ago, Paul. Is Ascot, does it have that similar, when you get there, that similar type of vibe that this is just a special place?
It does, but then you've got to look back at what you've got, and really what we've got is an absolute gift. It's a credit to our racing entity. It's a credit to the way our racing has been moulded in the way of keeping that TAB model where we've been able to have massive prize money. And to watch it here, it's all about the horse. It's all about the beauty of racing. It's not about that money, and that's probably the good upside to it. But owning a horse here is, at the end of the day, you're never going to make the money unless it heads to the breeding barn, I suppose. So it's grand. It's very, very grand. But it's also, when you look back at home and you think, gosh, we've got it right, you know, like, and I and that's some of the uptakes that I looked at today. But it's a vision splendor when you watch the whole crowd and the horses and the whole, you know, all the elements of the game over here. It is a great sporting event.
And Paul, what will your role be? What will your days look like in the next four? What will you be up to?
Oh, I'll probably keep going on the pims, I think. I'm quite fond of it. And today, you know, look, when it gets a bit around 30, you know, you'd like to drop into a couple of French Bordeaux type, you know, light type wines. But I think I'm going to stick with the pims. You know, tomorrow will be pims, and then But I'm actually looking forward to tomorrow. We've got, you know, my tip of the carnival is tomorrow. It's the Royal Hunt Cup. And there's a horse in the Royal Hunt Cup called Banksy.
Oh, no way.
And dead set. It's a no-brainer, isn't it?
Cannot lose.
Last start winner. It can't. It's just mortgage the house. The more you bet, the more you win. Let's go. I'm excited about tomorrow.
Taylor Adams, who's been terrific with us this year on The Breakfast Club, and we welcome him back. It is interesting to say, or to see him, 2 weeks ago when he came in, he was driving a Holden Camira. And today he rocks up in a Porsche 911 convertible after the big pay deal was announced yesterday. You move quickly, Taylor. Good morning.
Not quite half. We haven't seen that money yet, but no, it was a great result having that, what the AFLPA have done with that deal. It's been a long time coming, and they've worked extremely hard to get that across the line for us, and it certainly sets us players up for the next 6 years, not just for now, but the guys that are going to come into the system and become an AFL player in the next few years. So, yeah, we're wrapped. I think it just shows that, you know, as players, you know, we're a big part of the game, and I think the AFL respected that, and they've worked well with the PA to get the job done.
You're a senior player in the competition these days. What investment do you have in the process throughout it? I mean, obviously there's delegates from clubs with the AFLPA and they're keeping abreast of the situation and involved in the negotiations, particularly from an executive level. But what about just a senior player like yourself, leadership group player? How invested are you in the whole process?
Yeah, I was quite invested personally because obviously it plays a big part in your future, and obviously the financial side of it was quite important to the players. And throughout the year, Paul Marsh and his team at the PA would come in and visit us to give us the rundown of what's happening. And at times it was basically a standstill, but you know, to his credit and his team's credit, they've done a great job at getting this through. And yeah, it was all players get the opportunity to vote, and yeah, it was overwhelming. We voted in yes of the, I think there's like five main things that the PA have put forward to the AFL, and
yep,
we're wrapped to get those across.
Taylor, as a current player, can you cast your mind to the things outside just the pay for the current players and the conditions that go around that for things like retirement and hardship funds and that sort of thing? Is that kind of on your radar, or is
it
more
absolutely
focused?
Yeah, I think for our footy club are pretty lucky. There's a lot of things that work with the travel for the two Perth teams. Little things like just sitting in business or first class for those teams. I know obviously they travel a lot more than us. The accommodation when you travel, so you now get your own room. And I know we've been doing that at Collingwood for the last 3 years, but that was a big thing for the players. The educational side of things, so the grants and being able to study and the AFL pushing clubs being letting players study and do things outside of football is another big thing. And then obviously the retirement fund and the scheme they've gone with there. And that's obviously, you know, if you're lucky, you play 10 years in the system and you can set yourself up for life after footy. And that retirement fund certainly helps.
You're relatively still young, as half said, you're a senior player, but you're still relatively young. When are you starting to think about what you might want to do after footy? Have you started that process yet, or is it still something that's a way off?
No, I've certainly started that process. I've done a few uni subjects over the last 2 years, and currently looking into what I want to do next. I've put that on hold over the last probably 10 months, but I'm really big on doing something outside of football, not just to take your mind off it, but to make sure that our life, the transition for into life after football is smooth. And there was that program that was run on the ABC not long ago about sports people who struggled to get their life on track after football and found it really difficult. And not that that's scary at this stage in my career, but it certainly is in the back of my mind.
How difficult is it to stay disciplined in your mind to make sure you are doing things outside football when you're getting this bubble and it's all about, you know, you're getting paid to perform on the weekend and to train really hard during the week. But how hard is it to be disciplined to say, no, I've still got to do things outside football to look after myself?
Yeah, it's really difficult. And I've found that more difficult over probably the last year since being I'm part of the leadership group and a few more meetings, a little bit of extra time at the footy club. It's just, you know, it's a bit of a challenge for me to make sure I'm organised. You know, you set goals on field, but also off field. And we've got a great player development program at the footy club. Brett McCaffrey's heading that up with Chris Dixon, who's come along this year. And, you know, they're big on having plans for players off the field and making sure that they're stable off the field. And that includes study or part-time work or doing a trade, whatever it may be. The club, and it's certainly changed in the last probably 4 or 5 years since I've been in the system, the clubs are huge on players and their off-field development.
The discussion on the media intrusion into the AFL players and the access to players and the relationship between media outlets and players. You're performing a media performance at the moment, Taylor, as part of your commitments to us here at the Breakfast Club, which we think is fantastic. Should there be, I'll ask you this one first up, should there be open access to players every week, a day a week at training for media to get stories and forge relationships with players?
I can only sort of speak for myself. I think that the way that clubs and the media handle the media at the moment can be done better. And I think that the reason behind it is players after a win feel like, yes, I'm happy to talk to the media, and then after a loss they don't want to talk to the media. So it's like picking and choosing.
Yes, that's right.
I'd be happy to speak to them. Well, I do it. I come in and sit with you guys and speak my mind and tell as much truth as I possibly can. But I think that these days players are so almost robotic in their answers that the media are just like, well, we're just going to have to sort of guess a little bit and go off what we know rather than going off what the players actually said. In terms of what happened the other night with Barks and the door-stopping incident.
Yeah.
I can agree with Bucks on a lot of things that he said, but also, on the other hand, as players, I think it's a great opportunity for us to sort of extend our connections with the media and do work outside of footy with the media. And, you know, some guys will want to go into the media after footy and you know, progress their career that way. But I can understand with Bucks why you can get pissed off with it all, because sometimes the media can take clips or 10-second snippets of what you've said and turn it into a completely different story, when in fact the 2-minute interview was completely different. But I think I heard Eddie say on Triple M that you can't expect people to sit there and watch 6 or 7 minutes of an interview, you know, 5 times a day.
Yep.
People won't do that. So they want to see the shortened version. And at times it can be perceived by people outside of the media and outside of our industry as something completely different to what we're trying to say as players or coaches. And that's where the frustrating bit is for us. I personally don't mind the door stopping. After a loss, it's annoying, but it's just part of it. It's sort of, yeah. I enjoy doing the media, obviously, and I know there's players that don't enjoy it, so they'll sit here and say, no, I don't want to speak to the media during the week, but... certainly a personal preference.
Taylor, I could see at the beginning of that answer you were kind of picking your way through and tiptoeing lightly. I think you are very open and honest with how you speak, but it's fair to say that you, as AFL players, are given a lot of messages and coached a lot about the way you should approach things and what you should and shouldn't say, isn't it? I'm assuming someone as confident as you, maybe not as difficult, but for a lot of players that would be a challenging thing to navigate.
Yeah, absolutely, especially obviously the younger players. And as I said, like it is a personal preference, and sometimes, I saw it in real life 2 weeks ago when I said something on the radio and it got blown completely out of proportion. In terms of it just lasted all week and was in the build up for our game, so that would certainly scare players off. The fact that if they did slip up, that it becomes something that's, you know, 7 days long and I was fine to deal with it, but I imagine some players might struggle to deal with something like that.
I want to ask you about that because it was obviously the comments about successful footy clubs and all that sort of thing, and you've said quite a few strong things in here just through the course of the first 3 or 4 months. To you, is that just noise? Is that just part of the week, the build-up to the game, or is it something that at times you felt burnt, or some of your teammates have felt burnt, and it's got quite personal. How do you cope with all of that?
What happened 2 weeks ago didn't bother me really at all. I came in here and cleared up as best as I possibly could, and moved on from that point. So,
but did you feel that you gave Melbourne ammunition? Did you feel, because this is the whole thing with the Tom Bug thing, is, oh no, they've given the Bulldogs ammunition and all that sort of thing, or is that just like, do players really care about that sort of stuff?
I wouldn't have thought so. I wouldn't have thought that you'd need ammunition. I know that, like, myself and Bernie, being the centre of it, it was very jovial for us. And the whole thing was, it was great that the game was getting publicity and being built up, but for Bernie and I know it was just, sort of a big joke, and IE said this, well, I'll say that. And, I think we can, I think as players, you're just so hell-bent on playing your role and doing the right thing for the footy club and for the team on game day, that if you're not up and about and, you know, want to go and beat the opposition as badly as possible, then there's no point being out there. So any extra ammunition, I wouldn't have thought, would have too much of an influence on the performance.
So going back to Sherelle's point about messaging and how that is so strong within clubs these days, if the messaging wasn't so controlled from what the football club want their players to articulate and the messages they want to get out there for that given week, and it was a more frequent and open conversation with a bit more depth to it, do you think that the little stuff, like that scenario with you and Bernie Vince, would get as much traction, or would you expect that because there would be more access to more players and more stories unfolding, that that would just be a part of the conversation for a little while and then you'd move on to something else?
There'd be bigger and better stories, I would have thought.
Yeah.
But the thing is, and it's hard for us as players, because there's certain journalists that you really respect and trust. And
it's an interesting point.
You've built relationships with in a personal sense, and you hear from people at the footy club that, I respect him, I trust him. And then there's others that you're not so trustworthy towards and you don't want to talk to. And so who am I to sit there and say, oh, no, I don't want to talk to such and such, but I'll talk to this person over here.
Yeah.
And
why are you pointing at Whitey, not me?
And that's where it becomes difficult. And, I can honestly say there's not too many journalists and reporters out there that I would have full trust in if I went and told them something confidential about the football club, that it wouldn't be in the paper or on the news the next day.
Caitlin Bassett became a Suncorp Super Netball champion. She was a premiership player after the big win by the Lightning over the Giants, and she has been good enough to join us about 4 days after, probably just recovering, I reckon. Good morning to you, Caitlin. Well done.
Good morning.
Great to have you on board. A premiership player in Suncorp Super Netball. How does that sit with you?
Yeah, look, it's a great title. It's something I've been chasing for 12 years now. So, yeah, it sits very nicely with me.
It has been a long time coming. The satisfaction, because the game was in hand with a fair way to go against the Giants on the weekend. You had it under control. The satisfaction when that final whistle went, can you talk us through that?
Yeah, look, I think for us it was just, it was a perfect performance for our team. We did start off a little bit slowly in that first quarter, but definitely built, and that last quarter he pulled away, and it felt really good to be out there and to win by that much.
Seabass, it's Sherelle here. We're probably both making a little more sense than last time we spoke to each other. How did you pull off after the celebrations?
Yeah, look, it's hard to say no when everyone in the bar buys you a drink, but I think it's the come down. It's after something that you've been working towards so hard for such a long time. It's kind of like you have a post-tour depression, and you know what that feels like. Yeah. But this week is all about reviews and looking back to see what we can do better for next year. And it's kind of hard to believe it's all over, and it is. I'm still pinching myself.
Yeah, I agree with that. And just taking the point from half about, you know, you played 12 seasons in Perth with the Orioles and the Fever. You finally got that elusive premiership, but it's not with the Fever. It's not with one of those West Coast teams. How does that sit with you?
Yeah, look, I think for me, the move to come to the Sunshine Coast Lightning was to do something different. And I was really, I wanted to keep playing netball. And I felt if I stayed in Perth, my game was getting a little bit stale. And I didn't want to lose the passion that I have for the game. And I knew as soon as I got to Sunshine Coast that I was nervous. I had butterflies in my stomach before the first training session. And that's a really good feeling for me. It's something that I hadn't felt in a long time. And so I've definitely, I've got that passion back for the game. And I'm really excited about Diamonds, which is coming up soon. And I, you know what, I wish I could have stayed and won a premiership in Perth. But I think the best thing for my game and for netball for me was to move to the Sunshine Coast.
Yeah, well, talk to us a little bit about that club setup. I'm sure you weren't the only one who had butterflies in the stomach, because you guys arrived and there was literally no club, no court to train on. That you've literally started this club from scratch, and really only a few months ago, you know, less than 12 months ago.
Yeah, look, it's hard to believe that, yeah, 12 months ago there was no such thing as Sunshine Coast Lightning. And I've been a part of setting a club up before. I was there when the West Coast Fever started at the start of the ANZ Championships. And, look, it's different when you have a member organisation behind you, and we don't have that. You know, Netball Queensland are obviously aligned with Queensland Firebirds, and so we are kind of out by ourselves, not in the sticks, but, you know, we are a regional setup in Sunshine Coast. And, yeah, it was, I guess, for myself and Diva and Laura Langman, from the start, it was a lot of hard work for us, making sure we got the important things in place, because when you do start a club, you need the basics. And, look, the club were amazing from the get-go. They brought us in. They wanted to listen to us. And I think that was the start of building our club culture, was that it was all in and everyone's ideas were thrown on the floor and they were taken. So it was really fantastic.
Was that one of the attractions, Caitlin, about going to a new club? Because I would imagine that you would have had opportunities to go to other clubs as well on the Eastern Seaboard, but was that one of the reasons you chose the Lightning?
Yeah, definitely, I think it was. It was the opportunity to be a part of something brand new and to have input into the start of a club. But I think as well it was the opportunity to work with Nolene Tarua and the playing list that she had put together. And I did a bit of research before signing, and, you know, no one had a bad word to say about her. And when I chatted to her on the phone, the passion that she had for the game and what she said she could do for my game in particular, I think it was too hard to turn down that opportunity.
So you hadn't spoken face-to-face with Nolene before you agreed?
Oh, no, definitely not. Nolene was the enemy. Being from New Zealand, I think I was a little bit wary to start off with, because, before that, definitely she was the enemy, her and Laura Langman. I think Cheryl can attest to that, but it's hard. You know, your enemies on court and friends off, and I didn't really know her that well before signing a contract, but definitely know her so much better after this year. And she's an amazing coach and even better, an amazing person.
Wally Lewis has been good enough to join us ahead of the coverage tonight on Channel 9. Good morning, Wally.
Good morning. Yeah, you're right there. I've been swimming for about the last 3 weeks since we got beaten in the series opener. It's hard to take, and every New South Welshman that I've seen ever since has been rubbing it in, and it's been nice and painful.
Not only beaten in the series opener, Wally, but beaten in the series opener at Suncorp.
Yeah, that happened very rarely. The home ground of the Queenslanders has been so successful over the years. But I think more than that, it was probably the way in which that defeat was handed down.
Yeah.
Made it even more painful for Queensland, because we managed to score just one try. And to be brutally honest, we didn't really look like we were going to score any more than that. It certainly was an embarrassing loss. But the one big thing that we've got this time around, we've got Billy Slater back. Now, the Melbourne Storm fullback has been one of Queensland's real inspirations in attack over the last decade. And to have him back on board certainly is a massive benefit for Queensland, almost as big as the inclusion of Jonathan Thurston, who missed the first game as well through to a calf injury.
Now, we often talk about great teams at this level of football and how important it is to have a great team. But when you've got superstar elements that can be included into that team, it does change the dynamic significantly, particularly when you're talking about those key playmaker roles, doesn't it?
Yeah, it certainly does. And Thurston's been a guy that really has dictated terms to any opposition defence for the last 10 or 11 years. And certainly the ability to have him on board leading Queensland's attack is going to increase Queensland's chances. But the one thing that they've had a little bit of trouble is just getting used to the size of the New South Wales team. They've got some massive players in it. And the guy that got man of the match in game one, Andrew Fifita, he's as big a player as we've seen in the rugby league circles, and he weighs about 125, 127 k's, and he's got remarkably surprising footwork as well. His speed off the mark, his sidestep, and then his ball control has been fantastic. So to win the game, they've certainly got to make sure that they restrict his effect in tonight's games.
Wally, was it a mistake that Billy didn't play the first game? And not just because of what he brings on the field, but just the culture challenge of him not being there?
Yeah, I'm glad you bring up that point, because a lot of the players were used to playing with Billy. They've been used to playing alongside him for the last 8 to 10 years, depending on the individual player. And he was one of those guys that just seemed to fit in so comfortably. I went on record in saying that I expected and I thought that he should have been selected. There was some concern by the selectors. They said that they just weren't sure that he was fully fit. He'd recovered from spending basically the last 2 years missing Origin through various surgeries. But his performances for Melbourne Storm in the build-up to selection were first class, and I thought that indicated that he was ready to roll. He didn't get the selection, and then he's gone out, of course, and played another wonderful game for Melbourne, two more actually for Melbourne. So they have no surprise to anybody that's seen it, his inclusion. And what he adds is self-belief for the rest of the players. They understand that he's always going to be guiding them from behind, giving them plenty of talk. He is one of the best talkers I've ever seen on a football field. I hope he can stay quiet at night. it's one of those things. You just get used to having a player like him alongside you. And whenever you get into a disastrous situation, you expect somebody like Billy to be there offering the best possible help he can.
Well, the Queensland coach Kevin Walters has been under a little bit of pressure after game one. Is it surprising that we hear the New South Wales coach Laurie Daly coming out defending him? That seems weird to me.
Yeah, well, they're best mates. They spend a lot of time working together in the television industry, and they spent plenty of time playing alongside each other when they were with the Canberra Raiders a number of years ago. In itself, I suppose it may seem a little bit unusual, but I wasn't too surprised with it. And the one thing that Laurie Daly doesn't want to give Queensland is another reason to feel like they've been insulted. If he had to come out there and really blasted Kevy and said, we don't think that he's been fair in the game tactics that he's been employing, and we expect him to get the sack, it'd offer even more fuel to Queensland's fire. So that to me is just an indication that Laurie wants to make it as cool, calm and collected as possible.
Rory Atkins, who joins us on The Breakfast Club on RSN 927. Good morning, Rory.
Good morning. How are we?
We are terrific, mate. How are you? What's happening over there in Adelaide?
Not too much. I'm going well, but I am currently sitting in the stand of Adelaide Oval waiting for training this morning. We trained in about an hour or so I got here a bit early so I can speak to you guys. So, I'm just hanging out in the stand now.
Just hanging out in the stand at Adelaide Oval. That sounds like a nice place to be.
Fresh.
I'm sure it is pretty fresh. The form of Adelaide's been terrific this year, and we knew that they were a decent team last year. What's been the turnaround this year? Why have you improved so much this year in 2017?
I think it's just the continuity of one being the senior coach, another season under his belt. I mean, last year was his first year as a senior coach, so he's got more experience at what the game of AFL is like in the head role. And following on from that, it's just the continuity of the playing group. So we've all played an extra 22 games together. We work out how each other play, and being a more stable unit this year.
Speaking of continuity, I mean, you've got continuity in your game too. You played most of the back end of last year, or in fact most of the games last year, and then you've played all games this year. I mean, how have you found getting into rhythm? What are you now, 44-45 games into your career?
So last year towards the end of the year I started to taper off a bit, just due to not being the biggest body going around. In my first full year of senior AFL football, I start to tire a bit. So I learned from that year and trying to implement things that won't result in that this year. But, I'm enjoying my footy right now. Being a part of the team, it's going really well.
Now, Thursday night footy, Rory, have you got a sort of a new hairstyle sort of or a recolour happening for tomorrow night's big game?
I actually did get it recoloured yesterday. But back to my normal brown. I kind of got the yellow cut out and just try to go back to the original. It was too much maintenance, as Sherelle could
yes, hell. Yeah. Oh God, what are you trying to say?
No, it was just
you could use a red colour extension.
Other guys, I'd say.
So this is a concession that it wasn't a good look, or just that it was just too hard to maintain?
Oh, no. I'm sure you guys would think it was a great look, but it was just too hard to maintain, yeah.
The bye week, did you spend much time, you know, pontificating about which hairstyle you should go to? What did you get up to?
So I grew up in Melbourne. I didn't head back there as I usually do. My sister came over with my two nephews, so I don't see her too often because she lives in Hong Kong and has for some time now. So, it was good enough for her to spend her weekends in Melbourne, but then during the week when I had some time off, she came to Melbourne and came to Adelaide and brought my nephews that I haven't seen too much of. So, spent some family time with them.
Rory, we spoke to Richard Douglas probably about 6 or 7 weeks ago, and he was talking about how much he enjoys playing football under Don Pike and the ability for Don to give you that license to just play. How much do you thrive in that sort of environment?
Yeah, that's right. Don's great like that. So I feel like I play my best football when I play instinctually and play the football that I grew up playing. Because, I mean, some guys get into an AFL environment, they lose their flair or lose what got them drafted. So, that's why we're all here. We're here for a reason. And sometimes it gets drummed out of you. But, yeah, he instills the confidence in us to play the way that we play. And sometimes if that, like, he'll let you know if that comes out of the team confines. But if it doesn't, I mean, yeah, he just gives you all the confidence in the world just to play football the way you know how to play.
That was the best of the Breakfast Club from this morning. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.